Welcome to Friend of Maryland. My name is Kat Pause, and this is a fat-friendly space. Today on Friend of Maryland, I share my most recent piece from The Conversation about why we need to move past the obesity epidemic. I chat with Dr. Robin Longhurst from Waikato University about her fat studies geography work. And I spotlight a tumble log from the Big Fat Feminist about being fat and romantically interested in others. Last week on the show, I shared the first piece that I wrote for The Conversation, an online magazine in Australia. Today, I thought I would share my most recent post. The piece is entitled Moving Beyond Weight: Why the Focus on Size is Bad for Our Health. Parents in Australia have made headlines expressing frustration with a healthcare system that confuses weight with health. They've been expressing their anger at two separate but related offenses. First, their active healthy children are being labeled obese, a term many in the medical and lay community falsely believe to be a disease diagnosis. Second, without being asked about their child's eating habits and activity levels, they're being counseled to ensure their kid starts exercising and cuts back on fatty foods such as whole milk. Many a fat person can understand the frustration of these parents as they frequently encounter doctors who refuse to treat fat patients, doctors who refuse to offer any treatment plan except lose weight, and doctors who regularly shame their fat patients for their fat bodies. You can read stories of fat prejudice in healthcare in the first Do No Harm blog. The discourse of the obesity epidemic results in anti-fat attitudes that influence the health of fat people through reduced access to health services, reluctance to seek health care, and poorer care from health care providers. Fatosphere bloggers have written their own stories about receiving poor medical care. Imagine being a professional dancer who is admonished by a doctor to begin exercising, or having your doctor dismiss the information you provide about your health habits or simply call you a liar. What's more, how we talk about obesity impacts the health and well-being of all individuals. Healthcare professionals are less likely to counsel slim patients about diet and exercise, perhaps falsely believing that they are already engaging in healthy behaviors because of their physique. Do you know a slim person who eats unhealthy food and never exercises? What about a fat person who exercises regularly and is very careful with the calories they consume? Or a fat person who eats unhealthy food and never exercises, because what does it matter when they are already fat and assumed to be unhealthy? What about a slim person who eats unhealthy food and never exercises and never worries about their health because they assume being slim means they must be healthy? Such assumptions are constantly reinforced by our culture. A Viewpoint article in a recent issue of the New Zealand Medical Journal provides an interesting case study for this point. The article features a list that the authors assert are non-essential, energy-dense, nutritionally deficient foods. Foods such as honey, fruit juice, jam, granola bars, and toasted muesli cereal join the ranks of the regular suspects of alcohol, cakes, donuts, and ice cream. The article begins with the usual obesity epidemic hand-wringing and concludes by suggesting that fat patients should be warned away from these foods. The news coverage has continued this logic, that obese people must be educated about these unhealthy and unnecessary foods. This is the usual discourse of the obesity epidemic, and it shows how the authors fail to recognize that if foods are lacking in nutrition, then all individuals, regardless of size, should be told to avoid them. Why is the focus, understood as prioritizing health, directed only at fat people, always assumed to be unhealthy simply because of their weight? We do a disservice to everyone when we get wrapped up in the hype of the obesity epidemic. It's time to move past the language of weight and hate and adopt the language of health, specifically of health at every size. Health at every size is a new medical paradigm that shifts the focus away from weight and back onto health where it belongs. It embodies a weight-neutral approach and doesn't support weight loss for its own sake. Unsurprisingly, there's confusion about health at every size. So let's clarify at the outset that it doesn't suggest that every size is healthy for every body. Rather, it asserts that every body, regardless of size, is capable of engaging in healthy behaviors, and it is backed up by empirical evidence that finds improved health outcomes are possible independent of weight loss. Adopting the health at every size approach means moving past the discourse of the obesity epidemic. It means we stop talking about obesity and obese people and weight, period. It means we start talking about what we claim really matters, health. Moving past the obesity epidemic discourse means focusing on providing access to nutritious people for foods for people of all sizes, encouraging enjoyable movement for everyone, and ensuring that people of all sizes have access to effective and evidence-based healthcare. And it means we have to start talking about something other than what people weigh. Joining me today is Dr. Robin Longhurst, a professor of geography at Waikato University, who studies the intersection of body, gender, and space. Robin, thank you so much for joining me on Friend of Maryland.
Oh, it's great to be here, Kate.
So I think a lot of people are probably going to go, a geographer who studies body, gender, and space? What does that mean? What does that look like? So what would you tell them?
It's a common response. People certainly don't associate geography with studying issues around body size, but the kind of geography I do is very much human-based geography as opposed to physical geography, and it's very much about people's relationships with spaces and places. So if you think about it in that way, you know, it's not difficult to see why people's body size might be a really important issue here.
So what kind of specific research have you been involved in?
Well, I've been involved in this sort of broad area now for quite a few years, about maybe 6 or 7 years. And I started off thinking about what it means to kind of be a fat body. And I wrote about that because nobody in my discipline in geography had done work there. And it seemed to me it was an odd kind of a thing that people were prepared to talk about gender and race and ethnicity and age and all sorts of other aspects of identity, but not body size. So that's where I started 7 or 8 years ago.
Well, and I guess if you think about it in terms of those different types of identities, like you were saying about like gender and race and age, when we're talking about like, you know, actual like geography in terms of like physical space, obviously body size has such a strong relationship to that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I think at that point I was a much larger woman than I am now, and I have been fat for, you know, a greater part of my life. And so I wanted to write about those experiences in quite a personal way, to talk about how that means that you have a particular kind of experience of environments, of spaces and places. And there had been a little bit of work done in geography on what are called obesogenic environments, talking about where people live in terms of their access to things like, you know, high energy, sort of energy dense foods and the like. But that never really worked, didn't sort of speak to my experience. I wanted to talk about the kinds of discrimination that I often would face on a daily basis, and I wanted to write in that lived experience, you know, into the discipline. So that was kind of how it all came about, really.
How do you find that that's often perceived by other people in your discipline?
Well, some people do understand it to be a slightly sort of unusual research area to be engaged in. But it's not at all a stretch. I mean, I started off academic life 20 years ago thinking about pregnancy and pregnant women's lived experiences of different places. And in a whole series of interviews I did back then, women would say, oh, well, I stopped going out to that place when I'm pregnant, or, you know. And so it wasn't for me to move on to a different kind of body shape to talk about at that point fat bodies.
Yeah.
It seemed to me it was just yet another aspect of one's subjectivity or embodiment that it seemed to me entirely feasible to talk about. So I don't have much time, I have to admit, for people who say, well, it's not a very valid subject area.
Well, they're always going to say that, though, right? Especially about things that look at marginalized parts of the population. So whether it's women or gays and lesbians or fat people, there's always going to be those that are quite happy to dismiss that as not real science.
And whenever you put new things on the agenda, I mean, 20 years ago when I started talking about pregnant women in geography, people thought that was kind of odd too.
Yeah.
But of course, now maternities and childbirth and pregnancy, there's an enormous amount of that kind of work that's been done in geography and, of course, many other disciplines, and nobody thinks in any way that that's in any way strange. So I'm sure it's only a matter of time before people don't think that this is in any way a strange sort of subject area to be engaged in either.
Mm. So you just returned from a conference, the Association of American Geographies Conference.
Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I know that you were on a panel.
Yes. Well, it was a fascinating conference. They call it the AAG, Association of American Geographers, and it's an annual conference, and it's huge. They often will have about 8,000 delegates there.
Oh, wow.
Just enormous.
Yeah, that is enormous.
It runs over about 5 days, and sessions start early in the morning and go till late at night. But there's never before, I don't think, been... there have been a few papers here and there presented on body size and shape, but this time around... And I have to say, I didn't organise the panels, but someone in the UK did. But we got two full sessions running, so that was really exciting. And there was some great work presented there, actually. It was really nice to be with a group of people who were doing similar kinds of things. You know, that's always very interesting.
So were the panels specifically about fat bodies, or were they just about bodies within geography?
Yeah, the organizers set it up. I think the sessions were called something like Size Matters, Theorizing and Researching the Embodied Geographies of Size. So that allowed them some scope to have participants talking about a whole range of different body size and shapes. Quite a number of the papers, I have to say, did focus on fat bodies. But there were also papers on people having weight loss surgery, and there was a paper entitled Space and Time Strategies of Dwarfs in Public Space.
Mm.
So there was a whole range of papers there being presented.
I really like the title Size Matters, right? Because that kind of plays on that question, like, does size matter? That's very clever.
It's very good, isn't it? And because I think from a geographical perspective, I think in the discipline there's been quite a cultural turn in recent years, and that means that the materiality of bodies has been quite ignored in some circles. So I think that whole idea of size matters, you know, it's important, but also we want to talk about the matter, the materiality of bodies. I like that too, yeah.
So what paper did you present at the conference?
Yeah, I presented one called Unfixing Body Size and Shape. And what I wanted to do was take a lot of the arguments that I'm very familiar with in feminist and queer theory, because I've done a bit of work in the area of sex and gender, and I wanted to think about, in the same way that theory's been used to unfix sex and gender, I wanted to think about how you could unfix body size and shapes. In other words, so that it, you know, you shouldn't have to be one size and one shape in order to feel like you're an okay person in this world, that there should be scope for a whole range of body size and shapes to be accepted.
Well, that just makes my toes tingle, to be honest, because I'm really interested in queering as a verb, as, you know, something we can use in scholarship to, you know, question or, you know, denaturalize things that, you know, that we consider essential and whatnot.
Mm.
Can you speak just a moment about kind of the issues of intersectionality from your perspective? Because I think that within fat studies as a discipline, and then also within fact activism as a movement, I think we're trying to kind of learn best practice from groups that have gone before us, whether it's women's studies or Maori studies or queer studies, in terms of making sure that we are being intersectional and considering different things. But since that's something you focus on in your work, how does that work for you?
Yeah, I think there has been a move in recent years to think beyond just simply one category of analysis, as it were, or one aspect of subjectivity, and to think about how something like body size and shape, of course, intersects with all sorts of other different aspects of who we are on a daily basis. So certainly I think queer theory allows that too. I think it allows for this sort of looking at the way in which we perform, you know, perform a range of identities and to think about the intersectionalities of those identities. So, you know, an example being, of course, it's not the same experience necessarily being a fat man as it is being a fat woman, or being a fat Māori man as a fat Pākehā man, or, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What I was trying to get at, really, and my work does tend to be quite empirical, but in this particular paper that I presented at the conference, I suppose I was arguing that it's timely to sharpen up our theoretical tools to think a bit more about some of these issues like intersectionality and how we might use feminist or queer theory to think more deeply and critically about the work that we're doing on body size and shape.
Well, it really is important work that you're doing, Robin, and I really hope that you're going to put in an abstract to present at the conference I'm hosting.
Oh, yes, Kat, I'll be there.
Okay, good. You know, because the title of that is Fat Studies, Reflective Intersections.
Yeah.
So it definitely sounds like I wrote it just for you, and maybe I did.
You couldn't keep me away.
Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on Friend of Maryland today, Robin. This has really been fantastic.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
I hope that you will come back and join us again in the future.
Sounds good, Kat.
In the spotlight today is a piece from the Tumblelog, Big Fat Feminist. The piece was published on February 2nd of 2012, and it's titled On Being Fat and Romantically Interested in Other People, a Rambling Confessional of Sorts. There is a trigger warning for rape for this piece. Quote, look, it's really fucking hard to be a fat person who happens to be romantically interested in other people, particularly when those other people are cis-het dudes. It's hard because when you grow up fat, you grow up believing that you're not ever going to be attractive to anyone. You don't even do this on purpose. The world does it for you. For me, they did it through fat jokes on Friends, fat jokes on Will and Grace, fat jokes on every single sitcom ever. Headlines on my mother's Cosmo and Self telling me, I wasn't supposed to be looking at them, but whatever. Both that my sexuality only mattered as long as it was relevant to men, and that being fat automatically made my sexuality irrelevant to men. No fat chick bumper stickers, bullying in school, and rampant self-hatred and body shaming in my family. I don't think I ever had any agency in deciding whether or not I thought I was attractive until college. I just sort of knew, because the world knew, that I wasn't. I was fat. How could I be? This was the daily fact of my existence. It means it was never, ever something I questioned. It means that when I did get a boyfriend at 15, I was actually surprised that he wanted to touch me. It means that there was always a part of me that wondered if it was a pity thing. It means that when he cheated on me with a much thinner girl and ultimately broke up with me for her, I assumed it was because I was no longer sexually attracted to him and never really had been. It means when I found the fat acceptance movement and realized all this I'd been told my entire life was total bullshit, I had to start unpacking some really toxic shit that I'd internalized. It means that now when I ask people out, the answer I'm terrified of is not no, but wait, what? Here's why. A no answer means that you are actually considered to be part of this person's potentially dating pool, even as a negative. You were there. You counted for something. The idea of your sexuality was not erased simply because you don't fit conventional norms of attractiveness. Wait, what? Means you were never there in the first place. Wait, what? Means that everything the world told you when you were little was 100% correct. Look. When you grow up fat, you're basically told that no one will ever want to fuck you. Not date, not kiss, not hold hands with you while you walk through a park and eating ice cream. These things aren't even considered, because if no one wants to fuck you, who would ever fall in love with you? Don't you know the only thing that matters is how attractive you are to heterosexual men? No, I don't care that you're queer. The opinions of heterosexual men are the only ones that matter. Duh. And you're told, often overtly, particularly if you're a fat feminist on the internet, that the only way you'd ever have sex is if you got raped. But ha ha ha, who would want to rape a fat girl? And fat girls can't get raped anyway because they're so desperate for sex, because no one would ever want to fuck a fat girl. Am I right? Of course, usually people grow up to the point where they can realize that none of this is true. It's actually, you know, kind of nuts. But there's still a part of you that believes, because there's a part of you that has always believed. And so the scary thing when you put yourself out there isn't, oh, sorry, I don't see you that way. It's, oh, I don't even see you. I've gotten a lot of, wait, what? In my lifetime. I've also gotten a lot of people who've told me that I'm amazing and funny and so intelligent and so fun to be around, but they can't date me. Sometimes there are legitimate reasons for this. Sometimes there aren't. Either way, the surface reason is never, I can't date you because you're fat. And I have no way of proving that the underlying reason is, I can't date you because you're fat. Probably because nobody in their decent mind would think of it in those terms. But I wasn't the only one who internalized all that no fat chicks bullshit when I was younger. And I have a sneaking suspicion that a lot of other people haven't taken the time to think that out, give it a once over, and decide it's trash. And you know what? Ultimately, it doesn't matter. Because what another person actually believes is completely secondary to the little voice in the back of my mind from my childhood. That voice will always, always be there. That voice is less audible now than it was when I was 15, but it's a seed of doubt. And I have days where it's all I can hear. I do not think I'm alone in this. An amazing friend of mine said to me recently, if a person says they can't date you for whatever reason, they're right. You don't want to be with that asshole anyway. She's right, of course. It doesn't matter why they can't, and it doesn't matter whether that little voice is right or not. Because the funny thing about that voice is that it is always fucking wrong. This is something that I remind myself of every so often. That voice is always fucking wrong. It's wrong because no one falls in love with weight. It's wrong because attractiveness is subjective. There is absolutely no one who is categorically, objectively hot to everyone ever. And most importantly, it's wrong because the things and people who started it talking certainly did not have my best interests at heart. So why in God's name should I take it seriously? No, really. Imagine if that voice was actually attached to a person who is telling you these things. You'd tell that person they were a fucking asshole. You'd fume. You'd maybe slap or punch it directly in the kidneys. Or maybe you'd run home and cry on the phone to your best friend or your mom. The point is that you would sure as hell wouldn't think it was the voice of reason. Why does that change just because it's a little voice in the back of your head? It doesn't. So next time that little voice starts yamming her way, tell it to shut the hell up. It has no idea what it's talking about. End quote. Thanks for listening to Friend of Marilyn. Friend of Marilyn will be on a 2-week hiatus as I travel back home to the States for some time with my family over Easter. Repeat episodes will air for the next 2 weeks, and a new episode will air on April 25th, 2012. Have a good holiday. Closing the show is B.B. King with The Thrill Is Gone.